This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Darth Bane, Dynasty of Evil, a novel of the Old Republic, by Drew Karpyshyn. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Prologue. Darth Bane, the reigning Dark Lord of the Sith, kicked the covers from his bed and swung his feet over the edge, resting them on the cold marble floor. He tilted his head from side to side, straining to work out the knots in his heavily muscled neck and shoulders. He finally rose with an audible grunt. Taking a deep breath, he exhaled slowly, reaching his arms up high above his head as he stretched to his full 2-meter height. He could feel the sharp pop-pop-pop of each individual vertebra along his spine loosening as he extended himself until his fingertips brushed against the ceiling. Satisfied, he lowered his arms and scooped up his lightsaber from the ornate nightstand at the side of the bed. The curved handle felt reassuring in his grip. Familiar. Solid. Yet holding it couldn't stop his free hand from trembling ever so slightly. Scowling, he clenched his left hand into a fist, the fingers digging into the flesh of his palm, a crude but effective way to tame the tremor. Moving silently, he slipped from the bedchamber out into the hallways of the mansion he now called home. Luminous tapestries covered the walls, and colorful hand-woven rugs lined the corridors as he made his way past room after room, each decorated with custom-made furniture, rare objet d'art, and other unmistakable signs of wealth. It took him almost a full minute to traverse the length of the building and reach the back door that led out to the open-air ground surrounding his estate. Barefoot and naked from the waist up, he shivered and glanced down at the abstract mosaic of the stone courtyard, illuminated in the light of Seutric IV's twin moons. Goosebumps crawled across his flesh, but he ignored the night's chill as he ignited his lightsaber and began to practice the aggressive forms of the Jim So. His muscles groaned in protest, his joints clicking and grinding as he moved carefully through a variety of sequences. Slash, feint, thrust. The soles of his feet slapped softly against the surface of the courtyard stones, a sporadic rhythm marking the progress of every advance and retreat against his imaginary opponent. The last vestiges of sleep and fatigue clung stubbornly to his body, spurring the tiny voice inside that urged him to abandon his training and return to the comfort of his bed. Bane drowned it out by silently reciting the opening line of the Sith Code. Peace is a lie. There is only passion. 10 standard years had passed since he had lost his orbalisk armor. 10 years since his body had been burned almost beyond recognition by the devastating power of Force lightning unleashed from his own hand. 10 years since the healer Kalib had brought him back from the brink of death, and Zanna, his apprentice, had slaughtered Kalib and the Jedi who had come to find them. Thanks to Zanna's manipulations, the Jedi now believed the Sith to be extinct. Bane and his apprentice had spent the decades since those events perpetuating that myth, living in the shadows, gathering resources, and harboring their strength for the day they would strike back against the Jedi. On that glorious day, the Sith would reveal themselves, even as they wiped their enemies from existence. Bane knew he might never live to see that day. He was in his mid-40s now, and the first faint scars of time and age had begun to leave their marks on his body. Yet he had dedicated himself to the idea that one day, even if it took centuries, the Sith, his Sith, would rule the galaxy. As he continued to ignore the aches and pains that inevitably accompanied the first half of his nightly regime, Bane's movement began to pick up speed. The air hissed and crackled as it was split time and time again by the crimson blade that had become an extension of his indomitable will. He still cut an imposing figure, The powerful muscles built up during a youth spent working the mines in Apatros rippled beneath his skin, flexing with each slash and strike of his lightsaber. But a tiny sliver of the brute strength he once possessed had been whittled away. He leapt high in the air, his lightsaber arcing above his head before chopping straight down in a blow powerful enough to cleave an enemy in two. His feet hit the hard surface of the courtyard stones with a sharp sudden smack as he landed. Bane still moved with fierce grace and terrifying intensity. His lightsaber still flickered with blinding speed as he performed his martial drills, yet it was the merest fraction slower than it had once been. The aging process was subtle but inescapable. Bane accepted this. What he lost in strength and speed, he could easily compensate for with wisdom, knowledge, and experience. But it was not age that was to blame for the involuntary tremor that sometimes afflicted his left hand. A shadow passed over one of the twin moons, a dark cloud, heavy with the threat of a fierce storm. Bane paused, briefly considering cutting his ritual short to avoid the impending downpour. But his muscles were warm now, and the blood was pumping furiously through his veins. The minor aches and pains were gone, banished by the adrenaline rush of intense physical training. Now was no time to quit. Feeling a blast of cold wind blow in, he crouched low and opened himself up to the force, letting it flow through him, drawing on it to extend his awareness out to encompass each individual bead of rain as it fell from the sky. He resolved not to let a single drop touch his exposed flesh. He could sense the power of the dark side building inside him. It began, as it always did, with a faint spark, a tiny flicker of light and heat. Muscles tense and coiled in anticipation, he fed the spark, fueling it with his own passion, letting his anger and fury transform the flame into an inferno waiting to be unleashed. As the first fat drop splattered onto the patio stones around him, Bane exploded into action. Abandoning the overpowering style of Dejimso, he shifted to the quicker sequences of Surisu, his lightsaber tracing tight circles above his head in a series of movements designed to intercept enemy blaster bolts. The wind rose to a howling gale, and the scattered drops quickly became a downpour. His body and mind united as one. He channeled the infinite power of the Force against the driving rain. Tiny clouds of hissing steam formed as his blade picked off the descending drops while Bane twisted, twirled, and contorted his body to evade those few that managed to slip through his defenses. For the next 10 minutes, he battled the pelting storm, reveling in the power of the dark side. And then, as suddenly as it had begun, the tempest was gone, the dark cloud scurrying away on the breeze. Breathing hard, Bane extinguished his lightsaber. His skin was sheened in sweat, but not a single drop of rain had touched his bare flesh. Sudden storms were an almost nightly occurrence on Ciutric, particularly here in the lush forest on the outskirts of the capital city of Diplona. Yet this minor inconvenience was easily tolerated when set against all the advantages the planet had to offer. Located on the outer rim, far from the seat of galactic power and far from the prying eyes of the Jedi Council, Ciutric had the good fortune to exist at the nexus of several hyperspace trading routes. Vessels stopped at the planet frequently, giving rise to a small but highly profitable industrial society centered on trading and shipping. More importantly to Bane, the constant flow of visitors from regions scattered across the galaxy gave him easy access to contacts and information, allowing him to build up a network of informants and agents that he could personally oversee. This would have been impossible had his body still been covered with the Orbalisks, a host of chitinous parasites that fed upon his flesh in exchange for the strength and protection they afforded. His living armor had made him nearly invincible in one-on-one combat. Yet its monstrous appearance had forced him to remain hidden from the eyes of the galaxy. Back then, his plans to build up wealth, influence, and political power had been crippled by his physical deformity. Forced into a life of isolation, lest the Jedi become aware of his existence, he had worked only through emissaries and go-betweens. He had relied on Xana to be his eyes and ears. All the information he received was funneled through her, Every goal and task was accomplished by her hand. As a result, Bane had been forced to act more cautiously, slowing his efforts and delaying his plans. Things were different now. He was still a fearsome figure to behold, but no more so than any mercenary, bounty hunter, or retired soldier. Clad in the typical garb of their adopted homeworld, he was remarkable more for his height than anything else. Noticeable, but hardly unique. He was able to mingle with the crowds, interact with those who possessed information, and forge relationships with valuable political allies. He no longer had to remain hidden, for now he was able to conceal his true self behind an assumed identity. To this end, Bane had purchased a small estate a few minutes outside Diplona, adopting the guise of siblings Sep and Alia Omek, wealthy import-export merchants. He and Xana had carefully cultivated their new identities in the planet's influential, social, political, and economic circles. Their estate was close enough to the city to give them easy access to everything Sutrek had to offer, yet isolated enough to allow Xana to continue her lessons in the ways of the Sith. Stagnation and complacency were the seeds that would lead to the ultimate destruction of the Jedi. As the Dark Lord, Bane had to be vigilant against allowing his own order to fall into the same trap. It was necessary not just to train his apprentice, but also to continue to increase his own skills and knowledge. A cool zephyr wafted across the courtyard, chilling Bane's sweat-soaked body. His physical training was done for the evening. Now it was time for the truly important work to begin. A few dozen strides brought him to the small annex at the rear of the estate. The door was locked, sealed by a coded security system. Punching in the digits, he gently pushed the door open and stepped into the building that served as his private library. The interior consisted of a single square room, 5 meters on each side, lit only by a single soft light hanging from the ceiling. The walls were lined by shelves overflowing with the scrolls, tomes, and manuscripts he had assembled over the years. The teachings of the ancient Sith. In the center of the room stood a large podium and a small pedestal. On the pedestal rested the Dark Lord's greatest treasure, his holocron. A four-sided crystal pyramid, small enough to be held in the palm, the holocron contained the sum of all Bane's knowledge and understanding. Everything he had learned about the ways of the dark side, all his teachings, all his philosophies, had been transferred into the holocron, recorded for all eternity. It was his legacy, a way to share an entire lifetime of wisdom with those who would follow him in the line of Sith Masters. The holocron would pass to Xana on his death, providing she could one day prove herself strong enough to wrest the mantle of Dark Lord away from him. Bane was no longer certain that day would come. The Sith had existed in one form or another for thousands of years. Throughout their existence, they had waged an endless war against the Jedi and one another. Time and time again, the followers of the dark side had been thwarted by their own rivalries and internal power struggles. A common theme resonated across the long history of the Sith Order. Any great leader would inevitably be overthrown by an alliance of his or her followers. Lacking a strong leader, the lesser Sith would quickly turn against one another, further weakening the Order. Of all the Sith Masters, only Bane had understood the inescapable futility of the cycle, and only he had been strong enough to break it. Under his leadership, the Sith had been reborn. Now they numbered only two. One master and one apprentice, one to embody the power of the dark side, the other to crave it. Thus would the Sith line always flow from the strongest, the one most worthy. Bane's rule of two ensured that the power of both master and apprentice would grow from generation to generation until the Sith were finally able to exterminate the Jedi and usher in a new galactic age. That was why Bane had chosen Xana as his apprentice. She had the potential to one day surpass even his own abilities. On that day, she would usurp him as the Dark Lord of the Sith and choose an apprentice of her own. Bane would die, but the Sith would live on. Or so he had once believed. Yet now there was doubt in his mind. 2 decades had passed since he had plucked the 10-year-old girl from the battlefields of Rusan. Yet Xana still seemed content merely to serve. She had embraced his lessons and had shown an incredible affinity for the Force. Over the years, Bane had tracked her progress carefully, and he could no longer say with certainty which one of them would survive a confrontation between them. But her reluctance to challenge him had left her master wondering if Xana lacked the fierce ambition necessary to become the Dark Lord of the Sith. Stepping into the library, he reached out with his left hand to close the door behind him. As he did so, he noticed the all-too-familiar trembling in his fingers. He snatched his hand back involuntarily, clenching it once more into a fist as he kicked the door shut. Age was beginning to take its toll on Bane, but it was nothing compared with the toll already wrought upon his body by decades of drawing upon the dark side of the Force. He couldn't help but smile at the grim irony. Through the dark side, he had access to near infinite power. But it was power that came with a terrible cost. Flesh and bone lacked the strength to withstand the unfathomable energy unleashed by the Force. The unquenchable fire of the dark side was consuming him, devouring him bit by bit. After decades of focusing and channeling its power, his body was beginning to break down. His condition was exacerbated by the lingering effects of the Orbalisk armor that had been killing him even as it gifted him with incredible strength and speed. The parasites had pushed his body well beyond its natural limits, aging him prematurely and intensifying the degeneration wrought by the power of the dark side. The Orbalisks were gone now, but their damage could not be undone. The first outward manifestations of his failing health had been subtle. His eyes had become sunken and drawn, his skin a touch more pale and pockmarked than was normal for his age. The last year, however, had seen more pronounced deterioration, culminating with the involuntary tremor that seized his left hand with increasing frequency, and there was nothing he could do about it. The Jedi could draw upon the light side to heal injury and disease, but the dark side was a weapon. The sick and frail did not deserve to be cured. Only the strong were worthy of survival. He had tried to conceal the tremor from his apprentice, but Xana was too quick, too cunning, to have missed such an obvious mark of weakness in her master. Bane had expected the tremor to be the catalyst Xana needed to challenge him, yet even now, with his body showing undeniable evidence of his growing vulnerability, she seemed content to maintain the status quo. Whether she acted out of fear, indecision, or perhaps even compassion for her master, Bane didn't know. But none of these traits were acceptable in one chosen to carry on his legacy. There was another potential explanation, of course. Yet it was the most troubling of all. It was possible Xana had noticed his deteriorating physical abilities and had simply decided to wait. In 5 years, his body would be a ruined husk, and she could dispatch him with virtually no risk. In most circumstances, Bane would have admired the strategy. But in this case, it flew in the face of the most fundamental tenet of the Rule of Two. An apprentice had to earn the title of Dark Lord, wresting it from the master in a confrontation that pushed them both to the edge of their abilities. If Xana intended to challenge him only after he was crippled by illness and infirmity, then she was unfit to be his heir. Yet Bane was not willing to initiate their confrontation himself. If he fell, the Sith would be ruled by a master who did not accept or understand the key principle upon which the new order had been founded. If he was victorious, he would be left without an apprentice, and his failing body would give out long before he could find and properly train another. There was only one solution. Bane needed to find a way to extend his life. He had to find a way to restore and rejuvenate his body, or replace it. A year ago, he would have thought such a thing to be impossible. Now, he knew better. From one of the shelves, he took down a thick tome, its leather cover pockmarked, the pages yellow and cracked with age.
Moving carefully, he set it down on the podium, opening it to the page he had marked the night before. Like most of the volumes on the shelves of his library, this one had been purchased from a private collector. The galaxy might believe the Sith to be extinct, but the dark side still exerted an inexorable pull on the psyches of men and women across every species, and a black market of illegal Sith paraphernalia flourished among those with wealth and power. The attempts of the Jedi to locate and confiscate anything that could be linked to the Sith had only succeeded in driving up the prices and forcing collectors to work through middle beings to preserve their anonymity. This suited Bane perfectly. He had been able to assemble and expand his library without fear of drawing attention to himself. He was just another Sith fetishist, another anonymous collector obsessed with the dark side, willing to spend a small fortune to possess banned manuscripts and artifacts. Most of what he had acquired was of little use, amulets or other trinkets of negligible power. Second-hand copies of histories he had memorized long ago during his studies in Korriban. Incomplete works written in indecipherable, long-dead languages. But on occasion, he had been lucky enough to come across a treasure of real value. The worn, tattered book before him was one such treasure. One of his agents had purchased it several months earlier, an event too fortuitous to be attributed to chance. The Force worked in mysterious ways, and Bane believed the book had been meant to come into his possession, the answer to his problem. Like most of his collection, it was a historical account of one of the ancient Sith. Most of the pages contained names, dates, and other information that had no practical use for Bane. However, there was a small section that made a brief reference to a man named Darth Ondedu. Ondedu, the account claimed, had lived for centuries, using the dark side of the Force to extend his life and maintain his body well beyond its natural span. In the typical fashion of the Sith before Bane's reformations, Ondedu's reign came to a violent end when he was betrayed and overthrown by his own followers. Yet his holocron, the repository of his greatest secrets, including the secret of near-eternal life, was never found. That was all. Less than 2 pages in total. In the brief passage, there was no mention of where or when Ondedu had lived. No mention of what had become of his followers after he was overthrown. Yet, the very lack of information was what made the piece so compelling. Why were there so few details? Why had he not come across references to Darth Ondedu in all his previous years of study? There was only one explanation that made any sense. The Jedi had managed to purge him from the galactic record. Over the centuries, they had collected every datapad, holodisk, and written work that mentioned Darth Ondedu and spirited them away to the Jedi archives, burying them forever in order to keep his secrets hidden. But despite their efforts, this one reference in an old, forgotten, and otherwise insignificant manuscript had survived to make its way into Bane's hands. For the past 2 months, ever since this tome had come into his possession, the Dark Lord had ended his nightly martial training with a visit to the library to ponder the mystery of Ondedu's missing holocron. Cross-referencing the manuscript before him with the vast wealth of knowledge scattered across 1,000 other volumes in his collection, he had struggled to assemble the pieces of the puzzle, only to fail time and time again. Yet he refused to give up his search. Everything he had worked for, everything he had built, depended on it. He would discover the location of Ondedu's holocron. He would unlock the secret of eternal life to give him time to find and train another apprentice. Without it, he would wither away and die. Xana would claim the title of Dark Lord through default, making a mockery of the Rule of Two and leaving the fate of the Order in the hands of an unworthy master. If he failed to find Ondedu's holocron, the Sith were doomed. Chapter 1.
Adhering to the rules established through the procedures outlined in the proceeding, as well as all subsequent articles, our sixth demand stipulates that a body of
Med Tandar rubbed a long-fingered hand across the pronounced frontal ridge of his tall, conical cranium, hoping to massage away the looming headache that had been building over the last 20 minutes. Gelba, the being he had come to the planet of Doan to negotiate with, paused in the reading of her petition to ask,
"Something wrong, Master Jedi?"
"I am not a master," the Saurian reminded the self-appointed leader of the rebels. "I am only a Jedi Knight."
With a sigh, he dropped his hand. After a moment's pause, he forced himself to add,
"I'm fine. Please continue."
With a curt nod, Gelba resumed with her seemingly endless list of ultimatums.
"Our sixth demand stipulates that a body of elected representatives from the mining caste be given absolute jurisdiction over the following 11 matters. 1. The determination of wages in accordance with galactic standards. 2. The establishment of a weekly standard of hours any given employee can be ordered to work. 3. An approved list of safety apparel to be provided by..."
The short, muscular human woman droned on, her voice echoing strangely off the irregular walls of the underground cave. The other miners in attendance, 3 human men and 2 women crowding close to Gelba, were seemingly transfixed by her words. Med couldn't help but think that, should their tools ever fail, the miners could simply use their leader's voice to cut through the stone. Officially, Med was here to try to end the violence between the rebels and the royal family. Like all Saurians, he possessed a binary brain structure, allowing him to simultaneously process both sides of a conflict. Theoretically, this made him an ideal candidate to mediate and resolve complex political situations, such as the one that had developed on this small mining world. In practice, however, he was discovering that playing the part of a diplomat was far more trying than he had first imagined. Located on the outer rim, Doan was an ugly brown ball of rock. More than 80% of the planetary landmass had been converted into massive strip mining operations. Even from space, the disfigurement of the world was immediately apparent. Furrows 5 kilometers wide and hundreds of kilometers long crisscrossed the torn landscape like indelible scars. Great quarries, hewn from the bedrock, descended hundreds of meters deep. Irreparable pockmarks on the face of the planet. From within the smog-filled atmosphere, the ceaseless activity of the gigantic machines was visible. Excavation equipment scurried back and forth like oversized insects, digging and churning up the dirt. Towering drilling rigs stood on mechanical legs, tunneling to previously unplumbed depths. Gigantic hovering freighters cast shadows that blotted out the pale sun, as they waited patiently for their cavernous cargo holds to be filled with dirt, dust, and pulverized stone. Scattered across the planet were a handful of 5-kilometer-tall columns of irregular dark brown stone, several hundred meters in diameter. They jutted up from the ravaged landscape like fingers reaching for the sky. The flat plateaus atop these natural pillars were covered by assemblages of mansions, castles, and palaces overlooking the environmental wreckage below. The rare mineral deposits and rampant mining on Doan had turned the small planet into a very wealthy world. That wealth, however, was concentrated almost exclusively in the hands of the nobility, who dwelled in the exclusive estates that towered above the rest of the planet. Most of the populace was made up of Doan society's lower castes, beings condemned to spend their lives engaged in constant physical labor or employed in menial service positions with no chance of advancement. These were the beings Gelba represented. Unlike the elite, they made their homes down on the planet's surface in tiny makeshift huts surrounded by the open pits and furrows, or in small caverns tunneled down into the rocky ground. Med had been given a small taste of their life the instant he stepped from the climate-controlled confines of his shuttle. A wall of oppressive heat thrown up from the barren, sun-scorched ground had enveloped him. He'd quickly wrapped a swatch of cloth around his head, covering his nose and mouth to guard against the swirling clouds of dust that threatened to choke the air from his lungs. The man Gelba had sent to greet him also had his face covered,
making communication all the more difficult amid the rumbling of the mining machines. Fortunately, there was no need to speak, as his guide led him across the facility. The Jedi had simply gawked at the sheer scope of the environmental damage. They had continued in silence until reaching a small, rough-hewn tunnel. Med had to crouch to avoid scraping his head on the jagged ceiling. The tunnel went for several hundred meters, sloping gently downward until it emerged in a large natural chamber lit by glow lamps. Tool marks scored the walls and floor. The cavern had been stripped of any valuable mineral deposits long before. All that remained were dozens of irregular rock formations rising up from the uneven floor, some less than a meter high, others stretching up to the ceiling a full 10 meters above. They might have been beautiful had they not all been the exact same shade of dull brown that dominated Doan's surface. The makeshift rebel headquarters was unfurnished, but the high ceiling allowed the Saurian to finally stand up straight. More importantly, the underground chamber offered some small refuge from the heat, dust, and noise of the surface, enabling them all to remove the muffling cloth covering their faces. Given the shrillness of Galba's voice, Med was debating if this was entirely a good thing.
"Our next demand is the immediate abolition of the royal family and the surrender of all its estates to the elected representatives specified in Item 3 of Section 5, Subsection C. Furthermore, fines and penalties shall be levied against..."
"Please stop," Med said, holding up a hand. Mercifully, Galba honored his request. "As I explained to you before, the Jedi Council can do nothing to grant your demands. I am not here to eliminate the royal family. I am only here to offer my services as a mediator in the negotiations between your group and the Doan nobility."
"They refuse to negotiate with us!"
one of the miners shouted.
"Can you blame them?" Med countered. "You killed the Crown Prince."
"That was a mistake," Galba said. "We didn't mean to destroy his airspeeder. We only wanted to force it into an emergency landing. We were trying to capture him alive."
"Your intentions are irrelevant now," Med told her, keeping his voice calm and even. "By killing the heir to the throne, you brought the wrath of the royal family down on you."
"Are you defending their actions? They hunt my people like animals. They imprison us without trial. They torture us for information and execute us if we resist. Now even the Jedi turn a blind eye to our suffering. You're no better than the Galactic Senate."
Med understood the miner's frustration. Doan had been a member of the Republic for centuries, but there had been no serious efforts by the Republic Senate or any governing body to address the injustices of their societal structure. Comprising millions of member worlds, each with its own unique traditions and systems of government, the Republic had adopted a policy of non-interference, except in the most extreme cases. Officially, idealists condemned the lack of a democratic government on Doan. But historically, the population had always been granted the basic necessities of life. Food, shelter, freedom from slavery, and even legal recourse in cases where a noble abused the privileges of rank. While the rich on Doan undoubtedly exploited the poor, there were many other worlds where the situation was much, much worse. However, the reluctance of the Senate to become involved had not stopped the efforts of those who sought to change the status quo. Over the last decade, a movement demanding political and social equality had sprung up among the lower castes. Naturally, there was resistance from the nobility, and recently, the tension had escalated into violence, culminating in the assassination of the Doan Crown Prince nearly 3 standard months earlier. In response, the king had declared a state of martial law. Since then, there had been a steady stream of troubling reports supporting Galba's accusations. Yet galactic sympathy for the rebels was slow to build. Many in the Senate saw them as terrorists, and as much as Med sympathized with their plight, he was unable to act without Senate authority. The Jedi were legally bound by galactic law to remain neutral in all civil wars and internal power struggles, unless the violence threatened to spread to other Republic worlds. All the experts agreed there was little chance of that happening.
What is being done to your people is wrong, Med agreed, choosing his words carefully. I will do what I can to convince the king to stop his persecution of your people, but I cannot promise anything.
Then why are you here?
Galba demanded. Med hesitated. In the end, he decided that straightforward truth was the only recourse.
A few weeks ago, one of your teams dug up a small tomb.
Down is covered with old tombs, Galba replied. Centuries ago, we used to bury our dead. Back before the nobility decided they would dig up the whole planet.
There was a small cache of artifacts inside the tomb, Med continued. An amulet, a ring, some old parchment scrolls.
Anything we dig up belongs to us,
one of the miners shouted angrily.
It's one of our oldest laws,
Galba confirmed.
Even the royal family knows better than to try and violate it.
My master believes those artifacts may be touched by the dark side, Med said. I must bring them back to our temple on Coruscant for safekeeping.
Galba glared at him with narrowed eyes but didn't speak.
We will pay you, of course, Med added.
You Jedi portray yourselves as guardians, champions of the weak and downtrodden. But you care more about a handful of gold trinkets than you do about the lives of men and women who are suffering.
I will try to help you, Med promised. I will speak to the king on your behalf. But first, I must have those.
He stopped abruptly, the echo of his words still hanging in the cavern. Something's wrong. There was a sudden sickness in the pit of his stomach, a sense of impending danger.
What? Galba demanded. What is it?
A disturbance in the Force, Med thought, his hand dropping to the lightsaber on his belt. Somebody's coming.
Impossible. The sentries at the tunnel outside would have...
Galba's words were cut off by the unmistakable sound of a blaster's retort. She staggered back and fell to the ground, a smoking hole in her chest. With cries of alarm, the other miners scattered, scrambling for cover behind the rock formations that filled the cavern. Two of them didn't make it, felled by deadly, accurate shots that took them right between the shoulder blades. Med held his ground, igniting his lightsaber and peering into the shadows that lined the walls of the cave. Unable to pierce the darkness with his eyes, he opened himself to the Force and staggered back, as if he had been punched in the stomach. Normally, the Force washed over him like a warm bath of white light, strengthening him, centering him. This time, however, it struck him like a frozen fist in the gut. Another blaster bolt whistled by his ear. Dropping to his knees, Med crawled to cover behind the nearest rock formation, bewildered and confused. As a Jedi, he had trained his entire life to transform himself into a servant of the Force. He had learned to let the light side flow through him, empowering him, enhancing his physical senses, guiding his thoughts and actions. Now, the very source of his power had seemingly betrayed him. He could hear blaster bolts ricocheting throughout the chamber as the miners returned fire against their unseen opponent. But he shut out the sounds of battle. He didn't understand what had happened to him. He only knew he had to find some way to fight it. Panting, the Jedi silently recited the first lines of the Jedi Code, struggling to regain his composure. There is no emotion, there is peace. The mantra of his order allowed him to bring his breathing under control. A few seconds later, he felt composed enough to reach out carefully to try to touch the Force once more. Instead of peace and serenity, he felt only anger and hatred. Instinctively, his mind recoiled, and Med realized what had happened. Somehow, the power he was drawing on had been tainted by the dark side, corrupted and poisoned. He still couldn't explain it, but now he at least knew how to try to resist the effects. Blocking out his fear, the Jedi allowed the Force to flow through him once more in the faintest guarded trickle. As he did so, he focused his mind on cleansing it of the impurities that had overwhelmed his senses. Slowly, he felt the power of the light side washing over him, though it was far less than what he was used to. Stepping out from behind the rocks, he called out in a loud voice, "Show yourself!" A blaster bolt ripped from the darkness toward him. At the last second, he deflected it with his lightsaber, sending it off harmlessly into the corner. A technique he had mastered years ago while still a Padawan. Too close, he thought to himself. You're slow, hesitant. Trust in the Force. The power of the Force enveloped him, but something about it still felt wrong. Its strength flickered and ebbed like a static-filled transmission. Something or someone was disrupting his ability to focus. A dark veil had fallen across his consciousness, interfering with his ability to draw upon the Force. For a Jedi, there was nothing more terrifying, but Med had no intention of retreating.
Leave the miners alone!
He called out, his voice betraying none of the uncertainty he felt.
Show yourself and face me!
From the far corner of the room, a young Itochi woman stepped forth, holding a blaster pistol in each hand. She was clad in a simple black cloak, but she had thrown her hood back to reveal the downward curving horns that protruded from the sides of her head and tapered to a sharp point just above her shoulders. Her reddish skin was accentuated by black tattoos on her chin, four sharp thin lines extending like fangs from her lower lip. The miners are dead, she told him. There was something cruel in her voice, as if she was taunting him with the knowledge. Gingerly using the Force to extend his awareness, Med realized it was true. As if peering through an obscuring haze, he could just manage to see the bodies of the miners strewn about the chamber, each branded by a lethal shot to the head or chest. In the few seconds it had taken him to collect himself, she had slain them all. You're an assassin, he surmised, sent by the royal family to kill the rebel leaders. She tilted her head in acknowledgement and opened her mouth as if she was about to speak. Then, without warning, she fired another round of blaster bolts at him. The ruse nearly worked. With the Force flowing through him, he should have sensed her deception long before she acted. But whatever power was obscuring his ability to touch the light side had left him vulnerable. Instead of trying to deflect the bolts a second time, Med threw himself to the side, landing hard on the ground. You're as clumsy as a youngling, he chided himself as he scrambled back to his feet. Unwilling to expose himself to another barrage, he thrust out his free hand, palm facing out. Using the Force, he yanked the weapons from his enemy's grasp. The effort sent a searing bolt of pain through the entire length of his head, causing him to wince and take a half step back. But the blaster sailed through the air and landed harmlessly on the ground beside him. To his surprise, the assassin seemed unconcerned. Could she sense his fear and uncertainty? The Itochi were known to have limited precognitive abilities. It was said they could use the Force to see glimpses of the future. Some even claimed they were telepathic. Was it possible she was somehow using her abilities to disrupt his connection to the Force?
If you surrender, I will promise you a fair trial, Med told her, trying to project an image of absolute confidence and self-assurance.
She smiled at him, revealing sharp, pointed teeth.
There will be no trial.
The Itochi threw herself into a back handspring, her robe fluttering as she flipped out of view behind the cover of a thick stone outcropping. At the same instant, one of the blasters at Med's feet beeped sharply. The Jedi had thought he had disarmed his foe, but instead, he had fallen into her well-laid trap. He had just enough time to register that the power cell had been set to overload before it detonated. With his last thought, he tried to call upon the Force to shield him from the blast, but he was unable to pierce the debilitating fog that clouded his mind. He felt nothing but fear, anger, and hatred. As the explosion ended his life, Med finally understood the true horror of the dark side. Chapter 2. The nightmare was familiar, yet still terrifying. She is 8 years old again, a young girl huddled in the corner of the small hut she shares with her father. Outside, beyond the tattered curtain that serves as their door, her father sits by the fire, calmly stirring a boiling pot. He's ordered her to stay inside, hidden from view, until the visitor leaves. She can see him through tiny holes worn in the curtain, looming over their camp. He's big, taller and thicker than her father. His head is shaved. His clothes and armor are black. She knows he's one of the Sith. She can see that he's dying. That's why he's here. Kaleeb is a great healer. Her father could save this man, but he doesn't want to. The man doesn't speak. He can't. Poison has swollen his tongue. But what he needs is clear.
I know what you are, her father tells the man. I will not help you.
The big man's hand drops to the hilt of his lightsaber and he takes a half step forward.
I am not afraid to die, Kaleeb tells him. You may torture me if you want.
Without warning, her father plunges his own hand into the boiling pot over the fire. Expressionless, he lets the flesh blister and cook before withdrawing it.
Pain means nothing to me.
She can see the Sith is confused. He is a brute. A man who uses violence and intimidation to get what he wants. These things won't work on her father. The big man's head turns slowly toward her. Terrified, she can feel her heart pounding. She squeezes her eyes shut, trying not to breathe. Her eyes snap open as she is swept off her feet by a terrible unseen power. It lifts her into the air and carries her outside. Upside down, she is suspended by an invisible hand above the boiling cooking pot. Helpless, trembling, she can feel wisps of hot steam rising up to crawl across her cheeks.
Daddy,
she whimpers.
Help me.
The expression in Kaleeb's eyes is one she has never seen in her father before. Fear.
All right, he mutters, defeated. You win. You will have your cure.
Sarah woke with a start, wiping away the tears running down her cheeks. Even now, 20 years later, the dream still filled her with terror. But her tears weren't those of fear. The first rays of the morning sun were streaming through the palace window. Knowing she wouldn't be able to fall back asleep, Sarah kicked aside the shimmer silk sheets and got up. The memory of the confrontation always filled her with shame and humiliation. Her father had been a strong man, a man of indomitable will and courage. It was she who was weak. If not for her, he could have defied the dark man who had come to them. If she had been stronger, he wouldn't have had to send her away. The dark man will return one day, her father had warned her on her 16th birthday. He must not find you. You must go. Leave this place. Change your name. Change your identity. Never think of me again. That was impossible, of course. Kaleeb had been her entire world. Everything she knew about the healing arts and about disease, illness, and poisons, she had learned at his knee. Crossing the room to her wardrobe, she began to sift through her vast collection of clothes, trying to decide what to wear. Her entire childhood had been spent wearing simple, functional clothing, discarding it only when it became too threadbare and worn to be mended. Now she could go an entire month without wearing the same outfit twice. She didn't dream about the dark man every night. For a while, in the first year of her marriage, she had hardly dreamed about him at all. Over the past few months, however, the dream had come more frequently, and with it, the ever-growing desire to learn the fate of her father. Kaleeb had sent her away out of love. Sarah understood that. She knew her father had only wanted what was best for her. That was why she had honored his request and never gone back to see him. But she missed him. She missed the feeling of his strong, calloused hands ruffling her hair. She missed the sound of his quiet but firm voice reciting the lessons of his trade, the sweet scent of healing herbs that had always wafted up from his shirt when he hugged her. Most of all, she missed the sense of safety and security she felt whenever he was around. Now, more than ever, she needed to hear him tell her everything was going to be okay. But that could never be. Instead, she had to cling to the memory of the last words he ever spoke to her. It's a terrible thing when a father cannot be there for his child. For this, I'm sorry, but there is no other way. Please know that I will always love you, and whatever happens, you will always be my daughter. I am Kaleeb's daughter, she thought to herself, still idly flipping through the hangers of her wardrobe. I am strong, just like my father. She finally selected a pair of dark pants and a blue top, emblazoned with the insignia of the Dillon royal family, a gift from her husband. She missed him too, though it was different than it was with her father. Kalib had sent her away, but Garen had been taken from her by the rebels. As she dressed, Sarah tried not to think of her crown prince. The pain was too sharp, his assassination too recent. The miners responsible for the attack were still out there, but not for much longer, she hoped. A soft knock at the door interrupted her train of thought. "Come in," she called out, knowing only one person could be at the door of her private chambers this early in the morning. Her personal bodyguard, Lucia, entered the room. At first glance, the soldier was unremarkable, a fit, dark-skinned woman in her early 40s with short, curly black hair. But beneath the fabric of her Royal Guard uniform, it was possible to catch glimpses of hard, well-defined muscles. And there was an intensity in her eyes that warned she was not someone to be taken lightly. Sarah knew that Lucia had fought during the New Sith Wars 20 years ago. A sniper in the famed Gloomwalkers unit, she had actually served on the side of the Brotherhood of Darkness, the army that fought against the Republic. But as Kalib had explained to his daughter on many occasions, the soldiers who served in the conflict were far different from their Sith masters. The Sith and Jedi were fighting an eternal war over philosophical ideals, a war her father had wanted no part of. For the average soldiers, who made up the bulk of the armies, however, the war was about something else. Those who rallied to the Sith cause, men and women like Lucia, did so out of the belief that the Republic had turned its back on them, disenfranchised by the Galactic Senate. They had fought a war to free themselves from what they saw as the tyrannical rule of the Republic. They were ordinary people who became victims of forces beyond their control, expendable pawns to be slaughtered in battles waged by those who believed themselves to be great and powerful. "How did you sleep?" Lucia asked, stepping into the room and shutting the door behind her to ensure their privacy. "Not well," Sarah admitted. There had been no point in lying to the woman who had been her near-constant companion for the past 7 years. Lucia would see right through it. "The nightmares again?" The princess nodded, but didn't say any more. She had never revealed the content of her nightmares or her true identity to Lucia, and the older woman respected her enough not to ask about it. They both had dark times in their past that they preferred not to talk about. It was one of the things that had drawn them together. "The king wishes to speak with you," Lucia informed her. For the king to send for her so early, it had to be important news. "What does he want?"
"I think it has something to do with the terrorists who killed your husband," her bodyguard replied, picking up a delicate black veil from its stand in the corner of the room.
Sarah's heart jumped, and her fingers fumbled over the last button on her top. Then she regained control of her emotions and stood perfectly still as the older woman placed the veil atop her head. According to Doan custom, Sarah was required to wear the mourning shroud for a full year following her husband's death, or until her beloved was avenged. Lucia moved with practiced precision, quickly tying up Sarah's long black hair and pinning it in place under the veil. The soldier was only average height, slightly shorter than her mistress, so Sarah bent slightly to accommodate her.
"You're a princess," Lucia chided her. "Stand up straight."
Sarah couldn't help but smile. Over the past 7 years, Lucia had become like the mother she'd never had, assuming her mother had served as a sniper with the fabled Gloomwalkers during the Sith Wars. Lucia finished adjusting the veil and stepped back to give her charge one final inspection.
"Stunning, as always," she pronounced.
Escorted by her bodyguard, Sarah made her way through the palace to the throne room, where the king was waiting for them. As they marched down the castle halls, Lucia fell into her customary position, one step behind and to the left of the princess. Because most people were right-handed, being on Sarah's left side gave her the best chance to interpose her own body between a blade or blaster fired by a would-be assassin approaching from head-on. Not that there was much chance of anyone attempting anything here in the walls of the royal manse. But Lucia was always ready and willing to give her life for the sake of her charge. With the collapse of the Brotherhood of Darkness 2 decades ago, Lucia, like many of her comrades who had served in the Sith armies, had become a prisoner of war. For 6 months, she had been incarcerated on a work planet. welding and repairing ships until the Senate granted a universal pardon to all those who had served in the rank and file of the Brotherhood's armies. Over the next 13 years, Lucia had worked as a hired bodyguard, a freelance mercenary, and finally, a bounty hunter. That was how she had first met Sarah, and how she had earned the long, angry scar that ran from her navel all the way up to her ribcage. She had been tracking down Salto Zendar, one of four Mirian brothers who had come up with a short-sighted plan to kidnap a high-ranking Mune official from the Intergalactic Banking Clan head office and hold him for ransom. The miserably ill-fated venture had resulted in two of the brothers being killed by security forces when they tried to break into the IBC offices on Munalinst. A third was captured alive, while the fourth, Salto, managed to escape despite being critically wounded by security forces. The reward put out for his capture by the IBC was big enough to attract bounty hunters from as far away as the Midrim, and Lucia had been no exception. Using contacts from her days in the Gloomwalkers, she tracked Salto to a hospital on the nearby world of Bandemir, where he was being treated for his wounds. However, when Lucia tried to take him into custody, a young human working at the hospital as a healer had stepped between her and her quarry. Despite the arsenal of weapons on Lucia's back, the tall, dark-haired woman had refused to back down, claiming she wouldn't let the patient be moved while he was still in critical condition. The healer had shown no fear, even when Lucia had drawn her blaster and ordered her to step aside. She had simply shook her head and held her ground. It might have ended right there. Lucia wasn't willing to shoot an innocent woman just to collect the price on Salto's head. Unfortunately, she wasn't the only bounty hunter at the hospital that day. Salto had been as bad at covering his tracks as he was at kidnapping. While she and Sarah were locked in their confrontation, a Twi'lek had burst into the room, blasters drawn. Lucia turned just in time to get shot point-blank in the stomach, her weapon falling from her hand as she slumped to the floor. When Sarah tried to stop the Twi'lek from taking Salto, he had slammed the butt of his pistol against the side of her skull, knocking her aside, then yanking Salto out of bed and dragging the moaning prisoner away. Ignoring the hole in her gut, Lucia crawled after them. She saw the Twi'lek get halfway down the hall before he was shot in the back by another bounty hunter looking to claim the reward. And then she blacked out. Official reports put the number of bounty hunters at the hospital that day at somewhere between 6 and 10. Unlike Lucia, most of them had no qualms about killing innocent civilians or one another to claim their prize. By the time the bloodbath was over, Salto was dead, along with two other patients, one member of the hospital nursing staff, three security guards, and four bounty hunters. The only reason Lucia's name wasn't on the list of casualties was because of Sarah. The healer had dragged her back into the room and performed emergency surgery while the gun battle raged outside. She managed to save Lucia's life despite being freshly pistol-whipped, and despite the fact that Lucia had stuck a gun in her face only minutes earlier. Lucia owed her life to the young healer, and from that day forward, she had vowed to keep Sarah safe, no matter where she went or what she did. It wasn't easy. Before marrying Garen, Sarah had moved around a lot. Never content to stay in the same place, she seemed to travel to a different world every few weeks. It was as if she was searching for something she could never find, or running from something she could never escape. At first, the healer had been reluctant to have someone constantly watching over her, but she couldn't stop Lucia from following her as she moved from planet to planet. Eventually, she came to appreciate the value of having a trained bodyguard on hand. Sarah was willing to go anywhere and try to help anybody, and the Outer Rim could be a violent and dangerous place. Over the years, however, Lucia had become more than just the princess's protector. She was her confidant and friend. And when Garen had proposed to Sarah, she accepted his offer only on the condition that Lucia still be allowed to serve at her side. The king hadn't liked it, but in the end, he had relented and made Lucia an official member of the Doan Royal Guard. But though she had sworn an oath to protect and serve the king and all his family, her true loyalty would always be to Sarah. That was why she was so nervous as they approached the throne room. Though she hadn't admitted anything to the princess, she had a pretty good idea of why the king wanted to see them. When they reached the entrance, Lucia was required to hand over her blaster. By custom, only the king's personal guard could possess weapons in his presence. Though she did so without comment or protest, she always felt uneasy when she didn't have a weapon within easy reach. She had accompanied the princess to enough audiences with the king to become accustomed to the magnificent blue and gold decorations of the throne room. But it looked different this morning, larger and more imposing. The typical crowd of retainers, servants, dignitaries, and honored guests were nowhere to be found. Except for Sarah's father-in-law and four of his personal guards, the room was empty. What was said in this meeting was not meant to go beyond these walls. If the yawning chasm of the strangely empty throne room bothered Sarah, she gave no outward sign as she approached the raised dais where the king was seated on his throne. Lucia followed a respectful three steps behind. Physically, the king resembled an older version of his dead son. Tall and broad-shouldered, with strong features, golden shoulder-length hair, and a closely trimmed beard that was slightly darker in color. But while Lucia had come to know Garen during his marriage to Sarah, she knew little of his father's personality. She only saw him from a distance at official functions, and in these settings, he had always been formal and reserved. At the foot of the blue-carpeted stairs, Sarah stopped and dropped to one knee, bowing her head. Lucia remained standing at attention behind her.
You sent for me, Your Majesty.
The terrorists who orchestrated the attack on my son's airspeeder were killed last night.
Are you certain?
She asked, looking up at the king seated in his throne above her.
A security patrol responding to an anonymous tip found their bodies this morning in an old cave they were using for their headquarters.
This is glorious news,
Sarah exclaimed, her face lighting up as she rose to her feet. She took a half-step toward the throne, perhaps to embrace the king, but her father-in-law stayed in his seat, unmoving. Puzzled, Sarah pulled back as his guards glared at her with suspicion. Seeing the king's reaction toward the princess, Lucia felt her stomach twist into a knot. She hoped none of the others could sense her anxiety.
Is there something you're not telling me, sire?
The princess asked.
Is something wrong? Are they sure it was Galba?
They've positively identified her body. Two of her bodyguards and three of her top lieutenants were also killed, along with a Saurian named Med Tandar.
A Saurian?
He was a Jedi.
Sarah shook her head, unable to make sense of the information.